evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Today is Monday, December 15, 2014. I'm John Tanza in Washington, and tonight we have a special program for you, looking back at the tragedy that began in Juba exactly 1 year ago.
An attack by a group of soldiers allied to the former Vice President, Dr. Riek Machar Senior.
Former U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan, Susan Page, was in Juba when the fighting began. She says the writing had been on the wall for months that South Sudan's young democracy could face a serious test.
The cabinet was dismissed in July, the entire cabinet. And for anybody who studies politics or is involved in diplomacy, that's generally going to be the sign of some discontent.
This and more in our special edition marking 1 year anniversary of the start of the fighting in South Sudan. It was a year ago today that shots rang out at night in Juba. And on this anniversary of the outbreak of the deadly fighting, peace in South Sudan still seems to be out of reach. Authorities from Jonglei State's Fanga County say there has been a renewed fighting in the county. Rebel factions reportedly took control of Fanga over the weekend. But as Jacob Achek reports from Bor, details have been difficult to confirm.
Though Jonglei State officials refused to comment on reports of clashes over the past weekend, Fanga County Commissioner Boss Cholmot says there had been violence.
No, Fanga is there is fighting going on between government and the rebel, and we have no clear, accurate information whether Fangag is under rebel or under control of the government. This is the only thing that we know because we don't have communication with them, and we have no communication also with the government forces. But there is a fight. People are still fighting.
Fangag was initially under rebel control until pro-government forces took control of the area on November 27. Chol says some civilians have deserted Fangag town and have fled to Fangag Island. He said there are no reports of civilian casualties during the fighting, which occurred between rebels and government forces. Chol says his county has endured too much suffering and loss over the first year, and it is growing more difficult to believe there will be really chance.
I think nobody is going to benefit the war unless people come down and discuss issues in a peaceful manner, because war is gaining just only losses of our people. Rebel are our people as well as SPLA soldiers. So I think the peaceful solution to the conflict is more favorable.
Chol is calling on humanitarian aid agencies to provide support and shelter for the newly displaced population in Fangag Island. Nothing, the area is already heavily populated with the migrants from Upper Nile and Unity State. From Al-Daraf, the Ayut County headquarters was recaptured by pro-government forces about 2 weeks ago, forcing rebel troops to withdraw from the area, according to local officials. Jonglei State officials declined to comment about the status of Fangag County. But Colonel Philip Aguer, the SPLA spokesperson, insists the area is calm.
There is no fighting that has been reported for the last 2 hours. No fighting.
Aguer declined to say specifically which of the rival forces, the government or opposition, is currently controlling Fangag County. He said Fangag is a remote area without a telephone network, which makes communication difficult. There is no immediate independent confirmation of the reports of this latest round of fighting in Jonglei State. For BOA News, I'm Jacob Achek in Bor, Jonglei State.
Philip Thornaleu contributed to this report. Last year, when gunshots rang out loud at night in Juba, President Salva Kiir said the country had survived a failed coup attempt.
An unidentified person near Nyakurun Cultural Center released gunshots in the air and escaped. This was followed later by an attack at the SPLA General Headquarters near Juba University by a group of soldiers allied to the former Vice President, Dr. Riek Machar Senior.
That was President Salva Kiir addressing the nation hours after the fighting erupted. Mr. Kiir appeared in a military uniform on a national television to explain what he said had happened overnight. Few in the international community believe that the unrest was sparked by an attempt to oust Mr. Kiir.
Your government is in full control of the security situation in Juba. The attackers fled, and your armed forces are pursuing them.
Some South Sudan in Focus reporters found themselves in the thick of the violence and confusion that followed when those first shots were fired on December 15. One of them was Mungume Debs Rwakarinj. He lives near Nyokuron Cultural Center, and it was, in fact, Rwakarinj who recorded the gunfire as it rang out that night.
I had the gunshot, and the gunshots were not ending. So I got a look scared as well. And what I did, I tried to go down and get my recorder and then started recording the sound of shooting. And I went out in the morning and people were running. People were trying to, while leaving their household, a few meters out from where I stay, like about 20 meters, people had been shot.
And did anybody think at that point that it was an attempted coup?
They seemed not to know by that time exactly what had happened, but all they knew was that there was fighting within the barracks between soldiers.
That was Mungume Debs Rwakarinj speaking to South Sudan in Focus editor Karen Zaivogo. Andrew Green was South Sudan in Focus, Juba bureau chief in December last year.
The fighting would continue throughout that night, sporadically, but pretty consistently, and well into the next morning when the sun came up, at which point we kind of were walking around outside of our house and we're seeing soldiers who were positioned on all the street corners telling us to go back inside. And there was also the sound of shelling, specifically when the government started to attack houses where they suspected that the former Vice President Riek Machar was living. At that point, there also started to be a rapid transit across the city on foot by people who were living on the outskirts of town that had seen targeted killings by armed men throughout the evening and whose neighborhoods had sustained the most serious fighting and who didn't feel safe. They were fleeing to churches and mosques, and it turned out the UN base was a very popular destination. I think everyone was trying to get someplace safe, and the window that opened up in the late morning, early afternoon when the fighting stopped briefly. It started again later that night, at which point, you know, it was not safe for people like Mugume to go back to their homes. That was when you started to see the beginnings of the mass displacement that have taken place over the last year in South Sudan, with people basically forced out of their homes, unable to return, many people not knowing what happened to their belongings, people who don't know what happened to certain family members. I mean, it was pretty awful and very disconcerting, and it continues to this day as fighting continues in South Sudan.
Around 1.2 million people are internally displaced because of the fighting. Another 500,000 have sought refuge in neighboring countries, according to the latest report by the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Former U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan, Susan Page, was also in Juba on the night of the December 15. Last year, she says tension had been running high for months before those first shots were fired. Page says the events that led up to the crisis in South Sudan could have been avoided if the leadership of the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement, or SPLM, had taken time to talk to each other. She says when President Kiir fired his entire cabinet in July 2013, 5 months before the violence began, tensions built up within the SPLM.
The biggest thing is the lead up to the events that transpired on December 15th. When I think about what was going on at the time, you know, we have to remember that the cabinet was dismissed in July, the entire cabinet. And for anybody who studies politics or is involved in diplomacy, that's generally going to be the sign of some discontent. So we were watching the signs about what was happening. And then I believe it was towards November or something a little later, the president dissolved most of the organs of the SPLM the ruling party, and those organs then were in turmoil about what to do. Were they still functioning, even though, and then there was a lot of back and forth about what the president said or didn't say, or how they were, his words were interpreted by members of the cabinet. And so there was quite a bit of confusion about what that meant. And so I would say that people were kind of bracing for some sort of confrontation. Obviously, we hoped it would not have been an armed confrontation. So there was a lot of militarization in town on the 14th and 15th as they held this Liberation Council meeting. So we had kind of differing accounts depending on, you know, maybe what individuals believe should happen.
Let me just pick your brain on what you were saying, that people were a little bit skeptic and worried. What was your worry?
There had been a lot of talk in the lead up, actually, to the cabinet being sacked. So there was a lot of confusion. And what made people worry is that South Sudan has a lot of ethnic tensions. And while nothing is in a vacuum, these are individuals who also have a history. So the fear was that this could turn into something that turned ethnic. And as we ended up later seeing, of course, unfortunately, that's what happened, where it may not have started that way, but people fall back on something that they know and are comfortable with, and that's their tribe or their ethnic background, their ethnic group.
Leading to the events that happened on the 15, 16, there was a close down of the town. The town was literally shut down. And we understand there was orders for American citizens to evacuate from South Sudan. But you decided to stay back. What was the motivation behind that?
I thought that it was really essential that the American embassy remain open. Of course, I don't get to make that decision alone. This went all the way up to our president, to President Obama, of course, the Secretary of State, National Security Advisor. Many, many people were involved in the decision to draw back the number of staff that we had on the ground in South Sudan. And as you rightly mentioned, we did advise American citizens to get out. We put on lots and lots of evacuation flights. We drew down the number of staff to about as minimal as you can imagine. But I felt it was absolutely critical that we maintain a presence. And so I stayed with about five other staff members behind, went to lots of evacuation flights, hoping that people would be back sooner rather than later. And in some cases, they were, which is great. We thought that staying open would also send a message to everyone involved that we want peace to be achieved. We don't want the situation to get more out of hand. And I do believe it had an effect.
This was happening when the memories of Benghazi was fresh in the minds of U.S. diplomats. Were you scared that your life was in danger?
I have to admit, I wasn't really scared. I mean, I think that everybody has a different way of reacting when turmoil is happening around. It was important for me to be the chief of mission and make sure that my people were safe. And we had an augmentation with army members that came to help to reinforce the embassy compound as well as the residential compound. But I think probably on the 16th was the most worrisome day, because the blasts were so loud and so close to the embassy, and then watching people as they trekked around the residential compound to the backside of the UN UNMISS compound. But I wasn't scared, just wanted to make sure that all of my staff, both Americans as well as, of course, the South Sudanese, were safe and that they did not leave their homes if they felt unsafe.
That's Susan Page, former U.S. ambassador to South Sudan. She was speaking to me last week at the U.S. State Department here in Washington. Ambassador Page is now a senior advisor in the office of the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan. Tomorrow, we will air the second part of our interview with Ambassador Page. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the UN mission in South Sudan relocates tens of thousands of IDPs to another site. Find out why and when we come back.
What do you think? people speak out on important questions. The question today:
have you had any bad experiences traveling elsewhere?
No, I've never had any bad experience because I don't travel that much. I travel once, maybe in a year, something like that, maybe going to the village. Yeah, I've never had any bad experience traveling.
Yeah, I did. One day I was traveling from Jugo to my home place, Obie. It wasn't really good experience for me, but I had to manage it, and I tried so hard to manage that. We were traveling. We were approaching a place called Rumbek. From there, we almost fall in an ambush.
Several times I've had bad experiences. I remember my last trip to Balaka. I had some irritating people inside the bus, so it was bad.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. We would rather bring you that story on the relocation of IDPs in our show tomorrow. But we have more on the humanitarian situation in South Sudan. Aid workers say 1 year after the violence broke out in Juba and spread to other parts of the country, millions of people remain in dire need of humanitarian assistance. South Sudanese especially need food aid, and humanitarian workers say they need nearly $2 billion to assist the still growing number of South Sudanese in need. For VOA News, Charlton Doki has this report.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or UN OCHA, estimates 6.4 million South Sudanese will be at risk of food insecurity 6 months from now as the two warring parties fail to reach a peace deal and fighting continues in parts of the country. According to UN OCHA's latest report, aid agencies will require $1.8 billion to help a little more than 4 million South Sudanese. Following a three-day visit to South Sudan late last month, Kyung Wakang, the UN's Assistant Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, said they needed $600 million by mid-February to pre-position relief supplies, repair badly damaged roads and airstrips that were flooded during the just-ended rainy season.
Funding that comes now will save more lives. And I appeal to humanitarian donor organizations to stay the course, to continue to fund us. The funding must be sustained to meet the great need to pre-position during the dry season.
According to the UN, the year-long conflict has already displaced more than 1.9 million people from their homes, including more than 1.4 million internally displaced people who are still living in camps. In addition, 472,000 South Sudanese have sought refuge in neighboring Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia, and Sudan, and more than 100,000 others have taken refuge at UN bases across South Sudan. UN OCHA says some 500,000 other vulnerable people are stuck in rural parts of Jonglei, Unity, and Upper Nile, where they are inaccessible by aid workers. Toby Lanza, the head of UN humanitarian operations in South Sudan, says even though aid workers helped avert a famine this year, millions of South Sudanese will be at risk in the coming year.
Despite the fact that this is the time of the harvest, there are twice as many people who are severely food insecure, twice as many as would normally be the case. As we go into the dry season, there are fears that there will be more violence. There are fears that the lean season will grip harder.
Lanza says the UN plans to provide aid to the most vulnerable, as well as improve the self-reliance and coping capacities of communities whose means of livelihood have been all but destroyed during the conflict.
And so this is something that we will be watching very closely. We will work closely with the authorities of this country to monitor the situation and to do everything we possibly can to reach as many people in need, and also to pre-position aid to make sure that when the rains return next May, we will be able to continue to help people if they remain in need.
But Kang warns that humanitarians can only do much when the warring parties refuse to compromise and reach a peace agreement.
Humanitarians will work hard to continue helping the most vulnerable, but we will never be able to keep up as the conflict continues to generate more people in need, more displacements.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki.
As prospects for a peaceful end to the conflict remains bleak, the humanitarian situation in the country continues to be unpredictable. United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, says its commitment to the people of South Sudan will not change. Nancy Limbaugh is USAID's Assistant Administrator for the Bureau of Democracy, Conflict and Humanitarian Assistance. She says her agency is now spending more money on emergency response. Limbaugh is calling on South Sudanese leaders to grant unhindered access to aid agencies delivering the much-needed relief items to thousands of South Sudanese affected by the conflict.
Because of the intense mobilization of humanitarian assistance, we, without question, kept the people of South Sudan, particularly in the three conflict-affected areas, from sliding into famine. It was becoming a very, very dire situation with families who were displaced, harvests that had not come through, people who were stuck in compounds. And USAID has put $720 million of humanitarian assistance into South Sudan.
And suppose the two parties agree on a peace deal in the coming days, what will be the focus of your agency?
We are eager to resume development activities. The people of South Sudan have fought long and hard for the kind of future that is safer, that is more equitable, that really builds a true democracy. And USAID, prior to the violence that broke out a year ago, had about $700 million a year for development activities. And we look forward to returning to that opportunity, to walking side by side with the people of South Sudan to a much better future.
My understanding is that your office has sent a disaster management response team to South Sudan as a temporary measure mm-hmm. to address the situation. Mm-hmm. How long are they going to be there?
So we mobilized a disaster assistance response team, or a DART, as we call it, a group of seasoned humanitarian experts last winter after the violence broke out. They will be there for as long as we need them there to help to manage our humanitarian response. They work very closely with the UN, with the NGO partners, with the government, and all actors for the purpose of ensuring that we have the best possible humanitarian response.
When the South Sudanese foreign minister was here in Washington last week, he said he's a little bit concerned when partners are talking about frustration, that some of their partners are saying they're frustrated that the government in South Sudan is not ending this crisis. Is that the feeling around here?
You know, we are at the one-year anniversary, December 15th, which marked really the beginning of a brutal chapter for South Sudan. This last year has been very terrible for hundreds of thousands, millions of South Sudanese people. It is high time for this to be over. We're very hopeful that all parties to this conflict will find a way to put the welfare of the people over any individual political gain. We're encouraged that they're moving seriously towards a peace deal in Addis. It is their responsibility as leaders to put the welfare of their people first, and the people of South Sudan deserve far better than to continue into a second year of the kind of violence that deprives them of their homes, of education, of health, of a way to make a living and feed their family.
I'm normally not comfortable asking this question, but this is what a lot of people in South Sudan think. What if the peace agreement is not signed? Would there be some sort of a donor fatigue?
I think the question is, on the one hand, a fatigue concern, but there's also just a concern of the growing number of crises and the shrinking budgets as we look across the globe. And there needs to be accountability for those who choose not to pursue peace, especially when it's in their hands. So I think that certainly in the United States, we remain very committed to providing humanitarian assistance to the people of South Sudan. We ask that there be opportunity to, at a minimum, use the roads. It's really the responsibility of every leader in South Sudan on both sides of the conflict, from the highest levels down to the commander level. Let the humanitarian assistance move on the roads. Help the people of South Sudan get the urgent assistance that they so desperately need.
That's Nancy Lomborg, USAID's Assistant Administrator for the Bureau for Democracy, Conflict and Humanitarian Assistance. She was speaking to me last week here in Washington. You are still listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. The Sydney siege is over. Australian police stormed a Sydney cafe, ending a day-long siege in which several people were held hostage. Security forces rushed into the Lindt Chocolate Cafe in Sydney's Central Business District early this morning. Live video from the scene recorded a barrage of gunfire and flashes before several people were carried from the building in Martin Place. Some individuals were rolled away on stretchers. Emergency workers could be seen performing chest compressions on one person outside the cafe. There are unconfirmed reports of casualties. Fighters from the al-Qaeda-linked Nusra Front and other Islamist groups have seized two strategic army bases in northwestern Syria. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said militants from a group called Jund al-Aska helped the Nusra fighters take the Wadi Daif base in Idlib province and the nearby Hamadiya base. The observatory says at least 31 government soldiers and 12 opposition fighters were killed in the fighting, which began yesterday. And finally, Hong Kong Chief Executive Lun Chong Ying says the territory's Occupy protests are over, but activists say they will return after police cleared the last of the demonstration sites following more than 10 weeks of protests. Speaking with reporters today, Lung says what he calls the illegal occupation activities have come to an end, but only after they had caused serious economic losses in the tourism and retail sectors. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam. Stop à la
guerre, stop à la guerre. That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Stop à la guerre, meaning Stop War by Fally Ipupa. We've been listening to Fally Ipupa with that beautiful song, Stop à la guerre. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.